This episode is brought to you by Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a new podcast, Scene on the Screen, presented by Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco on Lit Hub Radio, episode 182, Zero Zone. Today we're discussing Scott O'Connor's latest novel, Zero Zone, all about an artist, an installation she builds in the desert, and the scary cult-like followers it inspires. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need, where Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hi, guys.
Hey!
Hey!
It's December!
Oh my God,
we made it through
December.
November!
2020 is going to end.
I was thinking about New Year's. I actually hate New Year's. It's just an annoying holiday normally. I like New Year's Day and all the resolutions and stuff, but I was like, I'm going to have the best New Year's party alone in my house this year.
What is that going to mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Just
exactly?
You and a bottle of champagne? You
and
Greg
know.
And a bottle of champagne?
Yeah, I don't know yet, but I think it will feel like a true relief.
Yeah.
That this stupid year is over. This... So I don't know. I haven't planned my party. I'm taking suggestions.
Well, see, here's
we should all do it.
Here's the
just
thing.
Make a giant cake for you guys to eat by yourselves.
Like, oh, 100%.
We're going to finish this entire cake tonight.
Yeah, but the problem is we've just been eating all the cake we want at our house anyway
yes.
for the last 9 months.
Right, so what is the indulgence that will really
kale.
Send 22?
A sprig of kale. Well, here's the thing, though. So I'm looking forward to 2020 ending as well, and I'm looking forward to the new year. I think that's going to be great. But the problem is I turned 50 on January 10th.
Oh, my God.
And I'm beginning to have some
An
problems.
An existential crisis?
Really?
I'm beginning to have some problems. Not physical, mind you.
Mental.
last night I said to Wendy, oh, my God, my dad died when he was 67 years old. Does that mean I only have 17 years left in my life? And Wendy was like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Why would you even say that?
Yeah, what is wrong with you?
I'm telling you, I'm having a problem.
Todd, I'm with you. Not that you're going to die in 17 years, but I think those milestones, when you realize you're approaching... they have a big impact.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I turned 40 last year. I know, but I don't know. Like, whenever I get freaked out about that stuff, I just have to like ask myself, well, what is it that I haven't accomplished that I'm so worried about? You know, like, cause it's usually about like, and I end up kind of arriving at like, no, I pretty much have enjoyed my life. I've pretty much gotten, you know, the things, I mean, not everything that I wanted, obviously, and there's still goals, but like, I don't know, 50 is not that big of a deal, Todd. We were with you when you turned 40. I remember we were friends.
Wow.
Yeah, you were.
And did you freak out then?
A little bit, yeah. Well, the one good thing about turning 40, though, was that I went to the doctor on my, like, after my 40th birthday, and they were like, you need to stop eating red meat and lose weight. And I was like, oh, okay. And so
and
for the last 10 years, I haven't really eaten red meat. And I lost a bunch of weight, and then I gained it back because it turns out that, you know, if you just eat cream.
doesn't matter that you're not eating red meat.
It's still the
donuts
cow.
Donuts every day.
Yeah. I agree. Like, I'm not worried that the clock is ticking
Todd,
towards.
The point is, let me be a better friend and say, you have accomplished so much
I have.
In your life.
I feel great.
You have done so many great, wonderful things, and I am incredibly proud of you.
Thank you.
You I've done more at the age of 50 than almost anybody else I know at the
Aww.
Age of 50. So
thank you.
Please just be happy about that.
Like, I am, and my hair is still brown, so that's
yeah,
nice.
That's true, actually.
Can
you
I just
gone
say,
gray at all.
Yes, I agree with Ryder. You've done enough. You can die
I can
now.
Just quit? I just retire?
But
you could if you wanted to.
Sure.
I did.
But you wouldn't want to. You want to keep moving. You want to keep writing. You want to keep creating.
I do have
That's
20
so cool.
years at the UC. I could take early retirement.
But I want to say, I also want to say, that was just so What a nice exchange you guys just had. There was just an article in the Washington Post yesterday about how men are reevaluating their friendships because they can't, like, do shit together. So they're, learning how to speak openly to each other. Of course, there are so many men who are already amazing at that. But as a trend. So you guys are doing it. Wow.
Ryder and I are at the forefront of male vulnerability?
Okay. Slow your roll. But that's just so nice that you can say, like, hey, I'm afraid of dying, and your friend says, I'm proud of you. That's nice. We should all aspire to that.
I agree. I'm not sure that I'm afraid of dying, although I'm not like, angling toward it.
Well, let me put that in your mind.
I'm more just like, oh, fuck, man. Like, I don't want to get sick is basically what I'm saying. That's my fear is illness, not death. Because as a Christian, I'm not a Christian. Shit, I do fear death. We're totally fucked. But 2020 cannot end fast enough. I cannot wait for this godforsaken shithole dumpster fire of a fucking year to end. Mm-hmm. That being said, I got some really good early reviews for my new book.
Yay! And when
is the official release date?
February 2nd, 2021. Just this last week, I got... Actually, Ryder, this is an accomplishment. For the first time in my career, I got what is called a starred and boxed review. And what that means is that in Publishers Weekly, which is the trade magazine for book publishing, you can get a review. You can get a starred review, which is great. That means, like, it's a book of distinction. Or you can get a starred and boxed review. A starred and boxed review means, hey, everyone, not only is this a great book, this is something special. And I've never, ever in my life gotten a starred and boxed review until the November 23rd issue of Publishers Weekly magazine, where they reviewed my new book, The Low Desert, and starred and boxed it, and I about fell out of my fucking chair when it happened.
That's
awesome.
And how did you feel about what they actually said, like the content of the
review? Oh, I felt great. Yeah, they called me a master storyteller. I felt great.
Yes! Did you feel like they actually got the book too? Like the vibe, the tone and all the things you were going for?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of a weird book in that it's both hyper-realistic and then there's some stories in it that are sort of surreal or satirical. But there's a reason that I've written these surreal or satirical stories alongside these hyper-realistic stories, which is to show the absurdity of this criminal life and how easily we as consumers of criminal behavior for our entertainment will look at one thing and be horrified by it, look at another thing and find it funny and amusing simply by the way that the person has created that world. And so I had that in
it's
my
very,
mind.
It's very, very Coen Brothers-y of you, actually.
You know that's a good comp for what I was thinking when I was doing this.
When we were saying that, I was just thinking of, did you guys watch the Western anthology that the Coen Brothers did on Netflix last year?
No.
Oh, you got to watch it. It's amazing. So it's four or five films, I think. I'm blanking on the title, but you guys can look it up. Everybody can look it up. It's on Netflix, and it's basically their version of they're doing exactly that, but in a Western context.
Huh.
So it's like five different approaches to the Western, and the first one is absolutely absurd. It's a musical. It's hyper violent, and it has this, like, it's so jarring, but then you realize it's like a compendium of all the Western tropes, mm-hmm. and they're just sort of like blowing them out and showing you how crazy it is. And then, like, the next one is one of the most brutal films you've ever seen. And then they just kind of keep oscillating between that. So you're never sure which, you know, sort of short story in that anthology, whether it's going to be this, like, gritty, realistic, awful, like heart-wrenching thing, or this absurdist, funny, and they just keep going back and forth. So it sounds like a very similar project.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, there's a story in the new book called Goon Number 4, which is, I've just had this idea for years and years about writing a short story about that guy in the background holding the briefcase, you know, basically a red shirt from Star Trek. And I just, like, what's Goon Number 4's life like? Like, he's just walking around holding the fucking briefcase.
That's great.
And gets shot in the head, you know, or shoots some guy in the head. And so I wrote the short story, Goon Number 4. And in it, I use, like, I do all of the cliches to talk about his life. Like, it opens in the, you know, Saharan desert and, you know, in Hummers flying through the desert with drones shooting rockets at shit. And the guy's, you know, having a conversation about his life. And, you know, they got to murder a guy in the process. And so I'm playing with all of these conceits of the genre to show, like, how silly it is. But then right. the next story is one of those kinds of stories, you know, is some right. badass gangster tale. And so the end result being is that Publishers Weekly understood what I was trying to do, and that was very gratifying. Very gratifying.
Oh, that's so great.
That's
man.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so I'm excited. So that's the other thing I'm excited about for 2021, in addition to being one step closer to my own death, is the new book coming out in February. Looking forward to that.
Oh, great, man. Congratulations.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And
right.
look on.
Speaking of making art.
Hold on one second. Look on page, when you get the book, you guys, look on page, 288 for your names.
Do we got a thanks?
You got a thanks.
I'm going to star in box just my own name.
That's a good idea.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Zero Zone.
Yes.
All right. So Scott O'Connor is the author of the novels Half World and Untouchable. He's written a slew of short stories that have been published everywhere. He teaches at Cal State Channel Islands up in Ventura. And Zero Zone is a novel set in the late 1970s in and around Los Angeles. The book is centered on a character named Jess Shepherd, who is an artist who creates sort of interactive spaces, I guess mm-hmm. you would say, mm-hmm. like very visually inspiring interactive spaces for people to exist in. And one of her pieces is entitled Zero Zone that she built in the desert. And there is a tragedy that occurred in 1977 where a group of people refused to leave the installation. There was a police shootout, someone died. And then she was consequently attacked by one of those people. And the novel sort of jumps between time periods, telling us the story of Jess and the creation of the art piece and her backstory. And then it goes into the people who refused to leave the installation, why they were there. And we get the sort of, and then really it becomes a crime story.
Yeah.
Sort of a mystery crime story with Jess herself at the helm, leading the way into trying to figure out what was going on and why these people were so weirdly inspired by her work.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you guys think?
You know, the one word that I kept coming back to over and over again while reading this book is that it is elegant. It is an elegant yeah. book. And I mean that in all of the best ways. It is an adult thriller mm-hmm. about people with interesting lives and problems. Mm-hmm. Elegantly constructed to an ending that you could basically figure out about 100 pages in. like you have a pretty good idea with what's going to happen in the book, but it's actually sort of a unique kind of pleasure to read a smart yeah. intellectual book that raises questions about people, about crime, about art, and about society mm-hmm. all in the space of about 285 pages.
yeah.
Yes. And
super fast read.
Yeah, yeah, super fast read, elegantly written, elegantly constructed. It looks like a piece of art. It has an absolutely beautiful cover. And I was just totally smitten by it. I just thought it was yeah. a really great sort of book to read in the middle of winter, you know, or fall, whatever year this is.
Like it matters.
But it really brought up some big questions for me that we can talk about shortly about the role of the artist
yes.
after the
yeah.
art is created, yeah. which I think yes. is really fascinating, and which I suspect, Ryder, you have some unique feelings about.
Yeah.
Because as a person who's created art and then is a symbol of that art for the rest of your life, which I think is
right.
weird.
You are right. the installation.
You are the installation. wherever you go, Ryder, you are the installation. That's so weird. Right. I really appreciated it. I just thought it was just a smart, good book. Yeah, there are some predictable things, some you know, things we can talk about that didn't quite work. But all in, you know, just a really great, elegant novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was very excited to read about art installations without a mocking tone.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So
right,
for
because we've been in this period of like, yeah, every time. Yeah, art is always made fun of. Yeah. The art world is always made fun of. That's
right. Yeah.
So it was, for me, okay, so here's what I would say this book is about, including everything you said, Todd. But the main thing is like, because the frame is that she has this experience where she almost drowns as a child in the ocean, and there's this like weightless feeling, but that's not the word. There's a euphoric moment before the negative feeling of almost dying comes in.
Death.
That right. she that like guides her life, and she's
like
trying to
recapture. Like being 49. It's like being 49. Yeah.
And then there are other characters who have similar weightless moments, like seizures and some sex scenes. That it this book is basically like, how do you get back to that feeling, like the one feeling you've had in your life that seems transcendent? How do you create that through art, or find that through someone else's art? That is such a good question. It's such a fascinating question, and it gives a lot of respect to art installations that is very rare to see, you know, like that she can create a concrete block and place the windows in a certain way that you might have a transcendent experience, or and other installations that are described here. It was cool. Like, and I have not read other books about this subject.
And you know what's really cool too is like the author dreams up these art installations and writes about them in such
incredible.
A way as though they are real.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, I would like to go out and see the Zero Zone. That sounds cool. That sounds like a Desert X thing, you know?
That scared me so much when I started the book. Because I hate... It's one of my pet peeves. It's like, don't write about something that you can't... Like, that should just be visual.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I tend to not love... what's the word? Is it ekphrastic or whatever? The word for, like, when you're writing about... visual art.
Right.
I usually, my eyes glaze over. I'm like, no, just get to the dialogue and the characters. Like, do what books can do. And this book completely turned me around by the end. Like, this isn't giving anything away, but the final chapter is just this beautiful description of the experience of one of her artworks. Mm-hmm. And like throughout the book, there's, you know, descriptions of it. And I was on board with all of it. I just wanted to be in every one of them. I wanted to see them made. And I thought that was really cool. And then even there's a lot of filmmaking stuff in here too. And film, and at first I was just like, I don't want to read about movies. Mm-hmm. But I was totally, it completely won me over. So that is part of that elegance, I think, is that he pulls that kind of magic trick. Because that's hard to do.
Yeah, and I don't quite know how he does it. Like, I'm the same way, like, I was reminded of some John Irving novel, and I don't remember which one, where there's a bunch of, like, art, maybe it was Garp or something, where there's a bunch of art being described, and you're just like, oh, for fuck's sake, I can't take it.
Right.
But this, it was like, perhaps because the art that Jess, the character, is creating is such an extension of her emotional life, but in a way that is made, obviously, for the public, versus it being just a metaphor, you know?
Right.
And maybe that's how he's able to write it in such a concrete way. But also, he does it short. Like, he's not being super expansive about it. He talks about it, and it makes sense, and then he moves on. Because there's an art installation that she does when she's a younger person where she creates a room filled with light, and she has this epiphany of the only way to make it work is to remove all the doors. And I was like, oh, wow, that sounds like a really cool, you know, art experience to walk through. And it didn't seem highfalutin, for lack of a better term. You know, it just felt like, oh, that would be cool.
Well, I think you're exactly right that he roots his descriptions of the art in the experience of experiencing it.
Right.
You know, it's not like a description of a painting or a description of a room. He is connecting it through the characters experiencing it, and it is so emotional. And by the time you get to what the actual artwork is, you're like, oh yeah, I can see how this affects this character, or I can see how this, you know, translates into their life somehow. And that's really good. I mean, that's really hard to do.
And I think something cool about choosing this kind of art to highlight is it really brings the layman into the process of, like, there's three people, three parties involved in the art. There's the person designing the art. There's the person building the art. And then there's the audience who's entering it, you know?
Right.
And you know, I think we conflate the design and the build so much that people just respond to whichever one they care about more. Like, what I'm saying is when people walk up to a painting, they're like, well, I could do that, or my third grader could paint it. They're responding to the design. Like, it's too easy to build it. Or not to right. the design, to the build, to the creation. Right. Whereas he enters the mind of someone designing it, and then it's built by someone else. And I don't know, that was cool, just to focus on that one aspect.
But it's also because it works in juxtaposition to, there's another character. So Jess has a boyfriend named Alex, who is her romantic and sort of creative colleague throughout much of the book. But it's in the past. We find out early on that he has died. And the art that he creates is the kind of art that makes me want to put my fucking head through a wall, which is like the artist sits silently on brick and stares at you like, that's not art. That's you making me feel weird.
Lays down on a bed of nails.
It's like some art school shit that makes you, like, hooks you up with hot sex for about a year and then makes you a weird person. And...
Well, he does move on from that.
He does move on from that.
That's like what makes him popular, but then he becomes essentially like a documentary photographer.
Right, after he goes to Vietnam. And so, like, that period of time where he's, like, laying on a bed of nails or sitting quietly for hours on end is so pretentious, but I feel like Scott O'Connor is creating it as an obvious, like, oh, here's this pretentious Cal Arts sort of thing that people do. Or who's that woman who you have to sit across from her and try not to cry for hours on end?
Blanking on her name. Abramovich.
Maria something or other. That video. There's the music.
I'm pretty interested in her stuff. I kind of love it.
I'm interested in her and that particular thing, but not just like some low rent San Pedro version of it.
Version. Yeah, well, she was one of the first. Yeah. And for her too, there's also so much gender stuff going on that, like, if a guy was doing it, would not.
Yeah,
be
it'd just
be
creepy. Like, I don't want to stare in your eyes. And so this juxtaposition between like the pretentious sort of cliche of an art school thing, and then these huge art installations that you can walk through and you have these emotional experiences from is completely different. I mean, this is a thing that I'm sort of specifically into lately because out here in the desert, they do Desert X, which they do it here in the desert, and they also do it in the Middle East, where it's these huge art installations in the middle of the desert that you can walk inside of and live inside of, and you know, you can experience it. And it really actually is super interesting and inspiring and opens up realms of thought that you wouldn't have imagined. Like, there was one that they did at the last Desert X. They do it every 2 years. And it was a series of staircases. I wrote about this in a magazine, in Alta magazine. It was a series of staircases that went up about 20 feet in the air, no sides. And there was a circle of them, and there was about eight, and they were on the shore of the Salton Sea, and it was called, like, Stairway to Nowhere or something. And you look at it from the bottom, you're like, oh, that's weird, it's just stairs. But then you climb the stairs, and as you're climbing these stairs with no sides on it, with the Salton Sea all around you,
it must be terrifying.
The thought is, oh, I'm gonna fucking die. Like, I could die out here. This is not just art. Like, I could fucking die.
Right.
And that I really appreciate, and I wonder if my appreciation of that sort of thing that I've gone through helps feed into my appreciation of the art that's being talked about in this book.
Well, you know, for all of our discussion that we've been, we haven't talked enough about the fact that it's really a crime novel.
Oh yeah, it's a straight up crime novel.
It's a straight up fast moving mystery crime novel. And you know, in a lot of ways, while I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is kind of like if you took a Todd Goldberg novel and mashed it, you know, there's like a very, because it's a noir LA desert thing, but then it has this other sort of like artistic and filmmaking thing. I was like, oh, this is like Todd Goldberg and Ryder Strong sensibility kind of mashed together.
I thought
into
that
a book.
Too.
Ryder,
I
we
was
should,
like, that's cool.
We should adapt
this is,
this
if
together.
If we wrote a book together, yes, let's do it.
Let's do it. We finally
well, first
have
of all, this would be an amazing film. There's would, no doubt that it it's going film. To be an amazing film. Like, this is like a better Tarantino film.
Yes.
I love this. It's very cinematic, the way it's written, the plotting and everything. I was like, oh, so all that we've been talking about is sort of, Yes, like there, but really, when you're reading it, it's just a fun. There's really intense characters. Mm-hmm. They're really starkly drawn. Everybody is. I mean, it's almost cartoonish. It is almost like an Elmore Leonard mixed. You know, I don't know. There's something. It's pretty, again, elegant. Like you were saying, like it never feels. The tone never feels. The tone is perfect.
Yeah.
The tone is marriage.
Well,
of these things.
And we've left out a big part too. So. These people that go into Zero Zone and have to be dragged up by the cops, and there's a standoff and a person dies. The one person, Isabella, who's a teenage girl, she's the one who ends up attacking the artist, Jess, 2 years later. And what she does is she shows up to an art show where Jess is, walks up to her, and slashes her face. Mm. And doesn't kill her. It doesn't even scar her tremendously, but I mean, leaves a scar. But it's this act of public violence in front of all of these people at the middle of an art show that if Alex, her dead boyfriend who made weird art, like that's the sort of thing that would happen at one of his art shows. Someone would walk up and slash you in the face.
Right. Mm. Right.
And so the young woman gets arrested, obviously, after this. And she spends a couple of years in jail, but because she's a juvenile, she gets out of prison or of juvenile detention after 2 years and then goes missing. And what happens is that her family essentially contacts Jess and says, Isabella has gotten out of prison and has gone missing. Will you help us find
that
her?
That seed is basically the seed at the beginning of every
yes.
crime detective yes. novel. It's like the wealthy people on the hill mm-hmm. in like this strange, you know, like crumbling estate. And then like there's all this artwork. And then like she's got to sit down and like refuses to take the job of the detective. It's like, right. Oh my God, this is so, it's so, exactly like what was the book I was just talking about? The Galton case, the old school, like yeah. LA noir novels. And that's like on page 100 of this book.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's what this is going to become. I'm so on board with this.
So I want to push though here, because this is where I feel like we get into the artists, how responsible they are for their work conversation. To me, that scene, while I liked it, like something was happening in my brain that pulled me out, which was this pushes the realm of believability.
Right.
That anyone would call forth an artist to be like,
you're
responsible
for
my psycho kid. You know what I mean? We are supposed to buy like that. That is the main thing that everybody's grappling with in this novel is like, is Jess responsible for this incident? And while I appreciate that as a subject, like it is treated as like a very actionable subject. Like we have to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, I don't know if that would ever happen. Like if anyone would think that.
Right. The way he gets around that is by establishing that the father was a huge fan of Jess's work.
Right.
Sure.
And that he's this wealthy benefactor for her art and he collects her work and other people's work. So there's this implication that like somehow, you know, that the parents would make this assumption of that because that is a crazy leap, right? Like you're the only person who can get through to my daughter or find my daughter, you artist woman in LA. Like that, the only way that could be made is that they already as a couple believe in the power of art to such a degree and the influence it can have on the world. It's a tricky
thing. I mean this is sort of the territory of either buy the conceit or don't, right?
Yeah.
Like if you buy it, you'll go on. If you don't, like that's what I meant at the start of the things about sort of the believability is like, there's only one person that can find our missing daughter, and it's the very person who put her into jail
was
in the first place.
Was attacked by her.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's absurd, but
okay.
But is it any more absurd than in the Satanic Panic era or any other time where musicians have been blamed for a killing? After Columbine, for instance, the media or the public is saying, Marilyn Manson, you got to come out here and tell these people to stop killing each other. Eminem, you got to come out here and tell these people to stop killing each other.
Right.
Like I think there's a pretty clear parallel to that.
Yes,
that the art is causing people to do these things. The only person that can stop it is the person that's created the art that therefore has the power over that person, which is absurd.
It is, but it also, like, there's a really cool thing that he does, which is connects the creation of the art. So she created Zero Zone because of Alex's death.
Right.
So it is in a weird way, like, she does feel a connection to the creation of the art is sort of founded in a tragedy, mm-hmm. and death and a sort of desire to connect with death and to connect with whatever, you know, I don't know, like it, that, and the fact that Jess doesn't even really understand why she creates her art, I think is really cool. Like, it's not like, you know, she's not this figure saying, I make art to make you have this experience. She's constantly wrestling with that. She's constantly unsure of why she creates the work that she does. She just knows that it goes back to this drowning she had as a kid, to Alex's death, to, you know, and so she creates these spaces. And so in a lot of ways, she is herself curious as to why Isabella connected to the art, why this weird cult-like sort of thing happened to her art. And in some ways, you get the sense, like, that's a positive reaction for her. Sure. You know, it's not all, mm-hmm. it's not, you know, it's, and that I think is super, as opposed to like Marilyn Manson, who could, I think, kind of throw up his hands and be like, I just make music, man.
Right.
You know, like, this is all an act. Like, this isn't me. I put on makeup, I do a thing, I do a stage show, and it's music. Like, if people take it in this direction, that's crazy. She's kind of saying, if people take it in this direction, is it crazy?
Right.
Maybe it's not that crazy. Maybe this is the direction I was actually pushing people. And that is that's really a cool question to me. And yeah, maybe it is false. Like, I don't know, you know, it's because a very healthy person would just say, I'm just an artist, get the fuck out of my life.
Yeah.
But
she's not a healthy person. He's created a character that is fractured in the same way as all these other people.
But this goes back to the conversation we had last episode with
Natalie and Travis.
Yeah, what it's like being a soap actor and having people stop you on the street and saying, what you did to the Considines was unforgivable, you know? And, like, that's for a certain subset of humanity who cannot separate art from reality.
That's it.
That's it, you know? And so it's a really, I think it's in the way that Scott is asking this question in this book is, it's not even art that's participatory with the artist. They've created it, it's out there in the desert. That person's not even there. What you're making of it is entirely up to you,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
So yes, Julia, it's like, it's absurd that this wealthy family would be like, we can either get Sam Spade or we can get the artist.
The artist who our daughter stabbed in the face.
Yeah. But in the service of the actual novel, it ends up working really well. You know?
I was so on board.
Yeah, that's what you want to have. Yeah.
And in a noir novel, which this essentially is, like, you, I mean, you're absolutely right, writer. When you and I adapt this, it's going to be great. But in a noir novel, like, you need that person who has a super skill to go into the situation and try to write chaos, right?
Yes.
And so she's the only person that can go into this situation and write the chaos, because there is, mm-hmm. at the center of it, a chaotic evil in this character of Tanner, who's essentially like a cult leader. And so, like, he couldn't just be a cop. A cop wouldn't be able to stop anything. A cop couldn't get these people to talk. But the artist could, because the artist has the superpower.
Right.
I mean, and that's why it's elegant. Like, mm-hmm. like how he came to that thought. Like, here's the thing. Like, I have no fucking idea how someone comes up with a book like this. I have no idea. Like, I presume when someone reads a book of mine, they're like, oh, yeah, he's like, oh, hitmen, those are funny. Oh, rabbis, that's funny.
Put them together.
But, like, visual artist, cult behavior, 1970s, like, where does that even come from in the ether?
Well, I have to say, it makes sense to me. I mean, that was the question I was going to put to the table, which is, why is this set in the 1970s?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And I feel like the answer to that question is the connective tissue between the artists and the cult leader,
mm-hmm.
as sort of like two different figures that do the same thing, you know, in some ways. They inspire followers, they inspire experiences and thoughts, mm-hmm. in other people. And to set it in the 1970s, the late 70s, just makes it First of all, it makes it political in a way without having to mention politics at all. Like, there's Vietnam on the fringe of this book, but it's not really talked about. There's, you know, there's no overt politics in this book, but and yet it feels incredibly political just by its setting. And this question of, like, how is she different than Tanner, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that's kind of what the book ends up asking, because Tanner is this cult leader who's inspiring people. He seems to be helping people. There are people that seek him out because they want his wisdom. He is disfigured. He was born with bumps all over his body and his face. And so he spent the first part of his life as a sort of monster, you know, hunchback of Notre Dame figure who then becomes, you know, he finds this new confidence and then, sets himself up at a New Age bookstore and begins building followers, and it clearly a Manson-like figure. And the 70s setting makes that even stronger. And I don't know, like, if it was set in any other period, I'd be like, well, this connection between an artist and the power of the artist and the power of a, you know, culty, New Agey guy doesn't really make sense. But the fact that that moment, especially in Southern California, 1970s, it makes sense. Like, that does sound right, that could have happened. That is a valuable question that still lingers today. Like, what responsibility, you know, because in our media culture now, like, it spins into so many other questions. Like you were saying, like Marilyn Manson, like filmmakers. I don't know. It gets trickier. But in the 70s, it feels more rooted in a realistic question.
And there's also some easy things for why it has to be set in the 70s. If it were to take place now, Zero Zone would be filled with Instagram models, you know? I mean, that's just the reality.
People, like, would be running through the desert.
Yeah, they'd have Burning Man going on next to Zero Zone. So having the Zero Zone installation happen in 1977, it gives this image of, like, pilgrims descending on it versus Instagram models. So there's that. Yeah. It's also almost impossible to disappear in 2020. And so Isabella leaving jail and disappearing, well, she'd have a cell phone. They'd find her immediately, you know, like, and the criminal justice system also is such that right now, it's really hard if you have a felony and you're getting out of jail to not have a bunch of people watching your every single move from here on out. And there's cameras and all that shit. I mean, this is actually a problem an issue that I've been encountering in a lot of books I've been reading, like, to review and stuff. I just read a really good book called The System that I'm reviewing. The review will be out by the time this airs. By a writer named Ryan Gaddis, and it's a crime novel that takes place in 1993 and into early 1994 in LA, and it's about sort of a gang shooting and a descent into the criminal justice system. And the only way that the book can work, the only way that the mysteries can work, is that if people can't be tracked, if people don't have cell phones. Like, that's the only way that this mystery could happen, is if people didn't have cell phones. And so, like, in order to write compelling crime fiction where it's hard to find a person, it's almost impossible because everything's on camera, everyone has a phone, everyone's leaving a footprint behind, and so solving these crimes is a lot easier in DNA and all this other shit. And so it makes perfect sense to me that he said it in 1979, but, you know, the funny thing, of course, is that, like, that's 40 years ago. Like, we're reading historical fiction at this point.
So I think that's so fascinating, Todd, because I've had that thought watching, you know, mysteries set in the 90s and etc. I think it's gonna feel more and more like a historic genre, you know, as time goes on, unless the mysteries drastically change, which of course they will. But I have a totally different answer to this question that is rooted in nothing except speculation. I feel like the thing that holds this novel together are images. You know, so the images of the light, the images of the desert. I think I would not be surprised if this came to this writer as, like, some fully born images within the 70s, with the way that people looked, the kind of architecture, the cities. You know, it just feels like it fits together like a perfect puzzle, not like he had the story and then decided the 70s had to be where it was set. Right. I feel like it was fully formed with the lights, textures, design of the 70s in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I imagine he was probably inspired by the art world first and foremost, right? Like,
sure.
He probably was inspired by, like, that 60s, 70s art world and then spun a story out of that yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's possible.
It's also interesting to think about the fact that the birth of her art career as this sort of, like, space creation, you know, where you can go walk into something and have an experience, is rooted in when she's in college responding to this, like, male ritual that they do at her college, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. they weigh the women publicly.
Bananas!
And measure them. But it sounds like something
that's
that probably happened.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
a
I'm
thing.
Sure it was a thing.
For sure.
Yeah. Where they would take, like, all the guys would run around and it was like, haha, college hijinks. They drag women out into the public square and put them on a scale and measure them. And she had this experience happen to her, which is, you know, an attack, an assault. And she decided to create and then she herself was so angry and didn't know what to do with her anger that she threw a coffee mug and it shattered her across the wall. So she decides to build an art space where women can come in after, you know, they've had this experience and go into a room where they can just break things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, like, another key point to the timing, the setting, you know, the big difference between her and Tanner also, you know, because Tanner is violent towards women
yeah.
as a cult leader.
Right.
So he's saying he's inspiring people and he's seeking enlightenment in a way that sounds kind of like an artist. It seems like he's working it. But at the end of it, he still wants to be able to sleep with a bunch of women
right.
and beat them up if they disagree with him. And, you know, Jess as a figure, as an artist, clearly is responding to that as a cultural force. And I think setting it in the 60s and 70s helps that too. And makes that brings that theme front and center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And makes it, it makes it seem unusual what would be usual for us now, right? Like
right,
breaking
right.
norms back then is, you know, just sort of society today. Jesus
right.
Christ. The other thing that I thought was compelling is, you know, this is a man who's writing about women. And I didn't ever have any hiccups with it,
no.
Which is not always the case for me. But let's turn to our resident woman.
That's why I'm here.
I know. Were you thinking, well, this should be written by a woman? Does he do a good job? What
I
was
mean,
your feeling?
You can't really ask that because...
I just did.
I mean, it doesn't make sense to imagine that this character could be created by someone else. So the
right.
question that comes to me more is, like, why did he choose for it to be a woman? That
right.
That's the test, you know?
Okay, perfect.
Because is it because she's, I don't know. You know, I thought about it while I was reading it, and I ultimately, there are some red flags, you know, like the cheating, cuckolding woman with all these, like, you know, artsy lovers, but she's really the genius. I mean, to be honest with you, the first image that came to my mind, you guys are going to die. when it's like serious painter woman in her, like, painter clothes.
Right.
Was she's all that.
Which is being remade right now.
Yeah, being
is
remade.
It?
Yes.
Which is a trope, right?
Right.
It's this,
right.
like, shy, deep girl painting alone in her studio with her overalls and stuff.
Freddie Prinze Jr. as Tanner.
But she didn't... Yeah, I was fine with it. I was okay with it. Like, there was never a moment where I was like, this man has never met a woman in his life. but I feel like the danger is sometimes that women are treated as, like, extra special. The pedestal, the 11
right.
in Stranger Things thing, where they're,
right.
like, so deep and incredible that...
And preferably mute.
Yes, of course. And I also read this at the same time we've been watching The Queen's Gambit, which I do not like. For related reasons.
Wow, you are the one.
I haven't heard a bad thing about it. I've never seen it.
I know.
I haven't heard a bad thing
well,
about
it. Well, I watched the first episode and thought the first episode was terrible. And then Wendy kept watching it. And I think she liked the next five and then didn't like the last two.
Yeah. So I've seen about half of it. But I think there is this, like, genius woman thing that, you know, deserves to be questioned at every turn. Like, why are we putting this woman up so high? But I ultimately was fine with it. I thought it was cool. I thought she was a good character. Could do without her, you know, ruining another woman's life by sleeping with her husband. Oh. But I guess that's a trope that we mean.
I thought you meant ruining another woman's life by finding Isabella.
All the cult stuff I'm so good with.
We love a cult book. I mean, this is, if there's one universal truth about the Literary Disco crew, you throw a cult in there, we're in it.
But Ryder, this must have reminded you of Geek Love.
Oh yeah, I definitely thought about it. Yeah, the sort of, in the same way that Geek Love is, and I think this is really smart that Geek Love does and this book does, is that what the cult leader is preaching is just so awful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like this, it's so, you know, because as, it seems like in real life, you know, the Jonestown stuff, I mean, they're usually piggybacking on Christianity or something sort of positive or an already established system. And I think if you were to write about those fictionally, it becomes less interesting to a certain degree. Whereas like in this case, it's just this like, drive towards death.
Right.
It's just this like, there's meaning. There's, you know, there's, and I kept, they refer to the rupture a couple times in this book. And I kept thinking like, what an interesting term, because it's not the rapture, but it's similar. It's used similarly in this book that like what they're seeking in the room, you're like, what? Cause you're, that's the mystery, right? Mm-hmm. You're asking yourself constantly when you're reading this book, and I don't want to give anything away, but you're like, what is this? Mm-hmm. Is this something like, is there a magical system that this person is believing in? Is there a, and you know, I don't want to give anything away, so I won't kind of answer that question, but I love that shit. And I think, you know, the same way you're like, well, this is awful. No one would actually cut their limbs off like they do in Geek Love. No one would actually follow this, you know, scary guy around it, but then you're like, well, but that's kind of the point. Is that
no one actually
kind of, somebody does.
No one actually wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and play volleyball with Keith Raniere.
Exactly. Right. Because they do. They do. Going back to your points about the art world and the female art world, I was reminded of The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner. Did you guys ever end up reading that book?
Yeah, it's an excellent book.
It's an excellent book. And that one is very similar world, set in the 1970s art world, but
in New York.
But to me, you know, it's much more about, it's so much more grounded in reality as far as like what it was like to be a woman who was doing her own art or, you know, her own activities to the side of all these like men with their egos. And to me, that was a much more realistic depiction of what it was probably actually like to be the muse / best friend / artistic cool girl and all the problems that brought with it. Whereas I think Jess Shepherd, like you were saying, Julia, does end up kind of being a little bit of the manic pixie dream artist girl. Like,
right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like she's really cool. And I wonder how much of the inspiration came from this a sort of fantasy of like what would the cool, like, amazing, and maybe there were women that were this cool and strong and you know, but I feel like The Flamethrowers does a better job. It's a much more dense book. It's a much less satisfying novel as far as the story and the plot, but as far as reflecting that world, and it's obviously written by a woman too, which I think is part of the difference.
And it's about 700 pages longer.
Yes, it's very long, and it's mostly just an examination of those questions, right? Like there's not really a plot other than like, you know, who am I dating? Who am I not? You know, what country? There is a plot, but it's not like this.
This is a crime novel.
It's also very cinematic. Mm-hmm. This book, like it moves at a clip that is visual. Like you were saying, Julia, it's visual. It seems based on a lot of those visual tropes and like a sort of evocation of the time and the world, and that's enjoyable in its own right. Like, that is cool, right? That is a talent to be able to do that. So I'm not really comparing it to the flamethrowers and saying one is better than the other. I just think it's a worthy comparison in terms of, like, depending on what you want out of a book, you know? Like, and if you want more of a realistic depiction of what it was like to be a woman in the 1970s art world, read Flamethrowers. But this book sort of takes that basic idea and spins a great, great Tarantino movie.
I would go so far to say this would probably be better as an 8-episode limited series.
There you go.
Because there's a bunch of stuff that happens in the 1950s when she's a kid. Yeah. You know, there's this whole section where she and her brother, who we haven't even brought up, are living with their aunt after their parents die in the 1960s in Los Angeles in this sort of weird bohemian culture. I mean, I could get 8 episodes out of this.
Well, let's do it, Todd. Let's go.
I'm just saying. we could get a solid... Ryder, this is the thing that we do.
You guys better send some emails before this episode airs.
I'm going to talk to my people. Have them find the money.
I feel that way usually about once or twice a year when I'm reading something where I'm like, well, this has to be made.
Yeah.
And this was like... immediately I'm like, oh well, I in some ways I would almost rather watch this than read it. It's like this
well,
is incredible.
Yeah, because,
like,
if they make it into a television show that we've already sold, they'll have to build the art installations and then we get to see them and walk through them, and that would be badass.
Please invite me. I want to go.
It's a pretty closed set because of COVID, Julia, so I don't know if we can get you on.
I will wear a mask. I'll probably have to drive, though. That's a long
drive. Do we know any beautiful, mysterious women who could play Jess? Oh,
Natalie
Ryder. Why don't you walk into your home and talk to your lovely
Alex?
Wife? Alex is Jess.
No, I actually think Natalie, who was on our show.
Oh, Natalie would be perfect.
She's got to be a white woman. She's got to be, you know.
Yes.
But yeah.
But Alex is Auntie Ruth, the artist, the artist aunt in the 1960s. Oh, I see this.
I'll be Tanner. It'll be my comeback role. I'll just like wear like crazy prosthetic makeup and be all bumpy.
Oh, that'd be great.
Sounds great.
Ryder Strong as you've never seen him before. Literally.
Oh, God.
Wow. This is how the sausage is made, you guys. A bunch of dumbasses.
Pitching ideas. Talking about who they know.
I'm telling you, we could get this shit done. We could get this made.
This one seems inevitable. Somebody's going to make
it. I'm
going to
talk to my people. I think I just
never say my people. I just want you to know that when the rest of us in America hear that, we're like, ugh.
Oh, I just mean writer.
Okay, well, that's fine, but it's the equivalent of 80s asshole in a movie talking on a cell phone.
I am Drew Barrymore's husband to be in The Wedding Singer.
Yes. Glenn Gulia.
Yes. Well done, Julia. Well done.
Well, I must have mentioned this to you guys because this was a turning point literally in my life. When that movie came out, I was not I wasn't like a people are slamming me into lockers nerd, but I was like an unnoticed kid. But I was the only Julia in my high school. I was 14 or 15.
How's that possible?
And then that movie came out and everyone wanted to call me Julia Gulia as a joke. And I had a lot of friends.
Oh.
Interesting.
Yes.
And then suddenly you took off your glasses and people realized how hot you were. And
that
then...
part never happened. Still have glasses
Kiss
on.
Me.
And then Freddie Prinze Jr.
Ryder, did you say you've never seen The Wedding Singer?
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, it's so much fun.
Yeah. Have you never been homesick?
I guess not.
Plays constantly.
Well...
I recommend Zero Zone by Scott O'Connor, everyone. Go buy it. It's a good book.
It is a great book.
I guess we're done.
This is typically right where you say,
wow, are you okay, Ryder?
Literary Disco brought to you by.
We ended on such a solid, like,
yeah.
I thought maybe somebody, usually I jump in when it's a little awkward and somebody made a joke. Todd has said something inappropriate, and then I'm cutting it off. But...
Yeah, So we're done, writer. You can start.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez, who is going to cut out the last 5 minutes for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.